Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah, standing there behind the counter.
Kia ora, listeners. Today I'm here with Kelly Sheehan. Kia ora, Kelly.
Kia ora, Karen.
Kelly is one of the founders of Earth's End Publishing. Earth's End specializes in New Zealand comics and graphic novels. Earth's End is a young'un as publishing companies go, but has moved beyond the toddling stage. Would you agree?
Yeah, we've basically been going since 2014.
Yeah.
Well, that's when we started to think about putting the company together.
So at 5 years, that's actually not only past toddling, that's already about to enter school.
It is.
So this year they released their fourth book, which is Rufus Marigold by Ross Murray. So tell us some more about the origin of the Earth. Of Earth's End, Kelly.
Well, in 2014, there was a tour of Germany by a variety of New Zealand cartoonists, including Dylan Horrocks. And while Dylan was there, he met people who had German publishing companies that specialised in comics. And often there were people who'd started off as fans or amateur cartoonists. And he thought that there was the possibility of that in New Zealand. So when he came back, he spoke to me and he spoke to my friend Adrian Kennard. And he suggested that we put together a project like that, and we thought about it, and we thought we should include Damon Keane, who was a local cartoonist who was publishing an anthology called Faction at the time. And Damon had design knowledge, was used to working with printers, and he'd also run a crowdfunding campaign to get Faction off the ground. And after contacting him, he said he was interested. So then the next step was what we would publish. And the logical thing to publish was a comic called The Dharma Punks by local cartoonist Ant Sang. It was very well known. Ant had published it between 2001 and 2002. And when Adrian and I had been running a stall selling New Zealand comics at various events, people were constantly asked after issues 1 to 4, which Ant didn't have any copies of. He could only sell in 6, 7, and 8.
Something we're used to in libraries when things are out of print and people come in asking for them. Not the first one, yeah.
Yeah, people want to read things in order. So Ant was interested in that, so we planned the campaign and launched it, and it was pretty successful. We raised close to $15,000.
So that was with Kickstarter?
There was a big discussion about whether it would be Pledge Me or Kickstarter at the start, and it was the first of very many long conversations about things that we had differing opinions about.
Well, it's good there were three of you, though, because
it was difficult because Ant was also a voting partner, so often we would have two and two, and then we'd have to go back and have more conversation. So that was quite successful. We put the book out and we made enough to publish the next book, which was a re-release of a New Zealand classic, Terry Teo and the Gunrunners. And that led to our next book, Moa, another children's graphic novel, and then Rufus Marigold. So each project's paid for the next project along the line.
That almost sounds like you did it on purpose. Hopefully you did.
Yeah, we did.
That
was always the plan.
Yeah. So, also because it's really the other thing I was saying about, you know, disagreements, working through them, out of that kind of friction often come the best new ideas. And at least you didn't have that, if I misunderstand correctly, you didn't have the one guy with the deep pockets who then got to make the final call because...
Yeah, that was definitely the case. I mean, I think the long conversations took place because we all had very strong opinions. And also we had different areas of expertise, so we'd use that to decide things. And sometimes after you talk about these things for a long time, there's just a breakthrough moment. And that's what would happen when we'd suddenly look at it from a different perspective.
Yeah, and also, I think none of you were hired guns. You were all there for the passion, for the, you know.
Yeah, nobody gets any money, except for the cartoonist. which is relatively rare in New Zealand. It's not a lot, but people do have paydays from us, which is quite a rewarding feeling when we hit the send button.
Definitely sleep better at night. I think that's well said and well pointed out. So you were speaking, that's about the different areas of knowledge. So you had some marketing experience.
It's not so much marketing. Before I started to work in libraries, I'd worked in bookshops. I'd worked for both Unity
Books.
Should
I have said selling?
Selling's important. It helps you see the bookseller's perspective. I'd worked for Unity Books. I'd worked at Time Out Books in Mount Eden. I'd worked at various comic shops. Then I'd worked at the libraries. I'd also worked for a book distributor, Archetype, who at the time had Alan and Unwin as one of their clients, pre-Harry Potter, because ANU distributed Bloomsbury. And I'd also done a communications degree, which meant I had some idea about how to engage with media. So those were important skills and experience. Adrian had worked at Whitcles, and he was also working on his history of New Zealand comic from Earth's End. So he had knowledge of working with a publisher. And Damon, as I said, was both a designer, had experience with printers, and had managed a successful crowdfunding campaign.
Yeah, that's, I should have said when you just described your long experience, my compliments, that when I said marketing, I didn't really mean in the sense of creating a brand as much as I meant all those things that you said re-entered into what I was thinking. It was more about, you know, getting the thing in front of the public and how to make it attractive and something that appeals to people and interests them.
And when you're doing that, you're inadvertently creating a brand. So even if you don't go ahead with that idea in mind, it's going to happen. And I kind of had that realization last year when somebody sent me a comic proposal that I really liked. And I looked at it and I thought, this is great, but I can't sell it. It's not something that booksellers would associate with us. I don't know if they would know how to sell it. I don't know how I'd market it. I don't know how I'd set up interviews. And so I had to say no to it, even though I thought it was a great piece of work.
Yeah, that is always, they say, the hardest thing when you provide a service like that where people come to you and it's not about, I suppose anybody who's passionate about any product, even if it's athletic shoes, but I tend to think because I'm a reading and writing type of person, and you can see that it is a good thing, but you sometimes have to say no because otherwise you can't keep going with the work that you're doing.
Yeah, and the thing that I realized is that everything that we published basically has quite a New Zealand flavour. I mean, the Dharma Punks was very much set in Auckland in the 90s. Grafton Bridge is a character in it, Ant Sang would say. Terry Teo is perhaps the first New Zealand graphic novel. Then Moa is set in colonial New Zealand. And Rufus is a little bit of an exception to the rule, except the tone of it and its deadpan nature very much feels like Kiwi humour.
The office, thinking particularly about the scenes in the office.
Well, that's more to do with the kind of the very black nature of the humour, I think.
And so don't go into Rufus yet because we haven't even really introduced it. So nobody, unless there's listeners who are listening because they've already read it, which is totally possible. So let's talk about Rufus, the graphic novel that you think of as a person, was the tagline that I remember.
Well, I found that it was like every time we talk about it, we don't talk about Rufus Merrigold. We talk about Rufus, and it's the book, but it's the character. And he ingratiates himself so much to you that you feel like he is a real person.
Absolutely, I agree. So let's start with Ross Murray then.
So Ross is a cartoonist that lives and works in Mount Maunganui. He's also a commercial illustrator. He's worked for Lonely Planet, Rolling Stone. He took part in a McDonald's summer campaign a couple of years ago. So people might know his work without even realising it. Ross had had initial contact with Damon Keane, who'd done Faction and was part of Earth's End. And Damon had seen Ross's work online and approached him and asked him if he was interested in contributing to Faction, which Ross ultimately did, with Damon's climate crisis comic High Water. And then we asked him if he had anything else that he was interested in doing, and he did, and he told us about Rufus. He wanted to do it as a web comic, which we thought was a good idea, And so we supported him with a Creative New Zealand application, and that was successful. And then when that was completed, we decided we did want to do a collected version of it. So Ross again applied to Creative New Zealand, and again they supported him to do additional work for a collected version. And I think the webcomic of Rufus had 10 parts to it. Ross ended up doing an additional 14 parts. And then we applied to Creative New Zealand, and they gave us some publishing support. It was our first successful application.
So, shout out to Creative New Zealand. You picked a winner. So we've got a copy of Rufus Marigold sitting on the table here, and Rufus in the on the cover is a chimp wearing a white shirt and a red tie. And what does that relate to? Well, what is that telling us about Rufus?
In the book, Rufus suffers from social anxiety disorder. And if you were to talk to Ross about it, Ross would say that disorder is related to very primal feelings that were appropriate when we were on the Sahara and we were being chased by lions, but they don't work so well in the day of social media and working in an office and commuting.
We're in an open plan office.
In an open plan office.
Where everything has become the water cooler. Because, you know, in the old days, there was only when you went to the water cooler. Now in our open plan offices, it's water cooler all day long.
It is.
So, and Ross suffers from, have we said, social anxiety.
Yeah, Ross, yeah. And is the inspiration for the book.
Yeah.
In the present day, it doesn't nearly affect him as much as it used to. He's been able to treat it with medication. And I believe seeing a counsellor as well. And doing Rufus has really helped him as well, because it's opened him up to the realisation that he's not the only person that suffers from that particular disorder.
Which is possibly another side. Sorry, I just spoke over you, but just talking about the fact that he's designed as a chimp, we should say to people who haven't read yet that the other people in the office are designed as regular human beings.
For the most part.
For the most part, yeah, there are a couple. But it's to me, that immediately spoke of that feeling where you feel the odd man out and you feel like everyone's looking at you and not seeing what you would like them to see.
Yeah. Without giving anything away, at the close of the book, Rufus ends up talking with a surveyor, and he identifies himself as other with his ethnicity, and that was definitely designed. It was something that we had conversations about. Ross would say that Rufus is emotionally autobiographical, though he perhaps himself didn't get involved in some of the stuff that Rufus does. But it represents how he felt at a particular time in his life.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I went to see Alexander Chi at the Writers' Festival, and he was talking about a novel that he'd written about trauma, about suffering trauma, in his case, abuse as a child. And he said that people kept asking him why he didn't write a totally autobiographic, a memoir, that, you know, following this story, to tell this story. And he said, sometimes it doesn't fit in the boxes of actually what happened to you to communicate the feeling and the truth of what happened. You actually need to create a slightly different situation, which communicates it better.
Yeah. I think Rufus definitely represents a heightened version of Ross's experience. But at a baseline, it resonates. It's interesting. He wrote it for other people who suffer from anxiety, and specifically social anxiety disorder. And they do have a very personal response to it. It's very intense, you get the feeling.
Yeah, I thought one could say for people who suffer from social anxiety and people who are close to someone who suffers from social anxiety, because I don't suffer from social anxiety particularly, but there were scenes in there that I totally identified with, only I wouldn't have had quite a strong reaction, but inside me. But also people I know who do, it was an insight into some of their behavior that was puzzling to me from seeing it from the outside.
I think it definitely works both ways. I strongly empathize with the scenes with Rufus and the telephone.
Yeah.
I hate talking on the phone. It's not a comfortable or pleasant experience for me. I don't like it when it rings. And
what are they going to want from me?
Well, I think that's the primal response or what now. But yeah, it definitely helped with my empathy with the character, and it really opened my eyes as to how these things work.
It's really well done also in terms of empathy, because there's humor, which of course always is an immediate path. It's, on the one hand, the very heartbreaking insights, and yet at the same time, humor, which is allowing you to open yourself up to that insight, which is heartbreaking, do you think?
I think so, and it's, to some extent, it's taboo-pushing humor as well. There's things in there that will make people uncomfortable. The webcomic of Rufus is largely full of punchlines and humor. There's some exceptions to that. But when it came to the book, we encouraged Ross to think about that he didn't just have to have a laugh line at the end of every chapter. He could also have poignancy or sadness, whatever he thought was appropriate. And I think he was thinking in that direction anyway.
Well, that's a really good point, because when you're reading it through as a book, because you talked about the ending, didn't you? And that was added when you turned the webcomic into a book, was the ending reinforced?
Yeah, the book is basically deepened. The first half of it is the webcomic. And there's a little bit of shuffling of episodes, but first half webcomic, second half new material.
Yeah. So basically in turning it into a book, I hate people say basically, we'll go forward. In turning it into a book, the comics that had to sort of be standalone until the next one came along could in the book be read straight through, so you could have a chapter that ended on a down point and a pause and then move on to the next chapter, but then the end became stronger, was strengthened.
So, yeah, it was. They were definitely designed, I think, to become self-contained, but they combine to make a greater whole. And you can see the progression that Rufus goes through. The back of the book, the blurb that Ross wrote, it describes Rufus as seeking to be defined as something other than a complete and utter social nervous wreck.
Yeah, that's it touches on the other aspect that we didn't mention of social anxiety, which is the self-loathing, which is really well depicted in that, oh my God, did I just say what I thought I said? and just wanted to kill yourself, that, you know. Have you here because I think it's a wonderful book and I want everyone to find out about it. So let's talk about the production of it. What was that like? So
that was interesting. We had to decide what size and shape it would be. The way Ross had designed it for the screen meant that we had options. It's probably just over 200 pages, I think, 4 panels per page. But we could have blown it up so that it was 12 panels per page. And so that really did involve some conversation.
The two reasons being comparing 4 to 12?
Well, shops probably have a preference for things to be a particular size. It's all very well when it's new and it fits onto the display table, but after that, if you're lucky, it's going to go onto the shelf and it's going to be a perennial seller. So that's a consideration. I guess if it was bigger, people would be inclined to think of it as a children's book. Particularly in being a comic, means that there might have been some awkward moments for shops and consumers if that was the case. We also wanted something that people felt like they were getting value for money. It's $35, and you want to be able to look at that and feel like it's a worthwhile purchase.
There's a sort of a preciousness also to holding it in your hand, because this is the thing we always say about books. You know, there's the content that you're reading, but there's also just the physical pleasure. And it's got this lovely, very soft, you know, whatever. What is that that does that to some covers of paperbacks where they're so smooth?
You'd probably have to ask Damon or Ross about that. I don't know what the exact answer is. I suspect it's just the card type that we talk. Though the title is kind of embossed in a nice sort of way.
Yeah, it's got the embossing, and it's also got the, I love this term, the French flaps. Let's tell people what French flaps are.
So French flaps are the end pieces on a cover that fold inwards and usually have information about the contents of the book on the inside front cover, and on the back there's usually a snazzy-looking photo of the author that you wouldn't recognize them as looking like in real life.
Yeah, not sometimes posing with a dog, but not always. But so they're kind of like when you have a paper cover, a dust jacket on a hardcover book, those things that you're describing are written on the folds of the paper.
That's
whereas
correct.
In this case, it's actually written on the cover, which folds itself in, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's lovely. I find such pleasure in that. It's not used that often, is it? But it's so nice.
Well, we ended up with it because Ross had initially wanted it to be a hardcover book. And personally, I'm always reticent about that. It makes it heavier. It makes it more expensive. Damon and Adrian usually want it to be like that because at heart, we're all comics geeks. And that's seen as an aspirational thing, I think, in comics, that you have a hardback version of something on your bookshelf. But in the end, it didn't really make financial sense, especially with regard to how many copies we were printing up. So we offered Ross the French flaps in lieu of the hardcover, and then there were many long conversations about what was going to go on to those. And eventually we came up with the idea that we would try to summarise the contents of Rufus from selected panels on the inside and put those on those French flaps.
Oh, yeah, I can see that, yeah, yeah. And then when you you can go from the front to the back, and it's just four sort of flashes of what you'll be getting inside, as compared to the one that says, Jane was always wanted to leave her husband, but it was only when her son said da-da-da, and it gives you that little hyped blurb.
I particularly like the final image on the front inside back cover. I think it kind of...
That's
sums
beautiful.
Things out quite nicely about the character.
I'm checking it out right now. So this is Rufus close up. What do you call that? First, what do you call that in a movie when it's the closest thing to the front, the forefront?
Yeah.
There must be some name for that. Anyway, close up of Rufus, and he's actually looking into the distance, and his hand is casting shadow on his face.
Yes, he looks out onto a new dawn.
As he looks out into a new dawn. See, you put that in. It's not in the panel, but that's really great. Yeah, and that goes back to casting shade, which is a term that I'm embarrassed to say I only picked up recently, which is a very handy term. Do you know about casting shade?
Yeah, I heard about it on a podcast recently.
Yeah, did you hear about Nancy Pelosi possibly doing a Trump? That was that was where I learned about
it. Well, it was in relation to Paris's burning.
Oh, right. So let's talk about, we've still got some time to get into this. So the book design, you're learning all the time, right? We can say.
I think I tend to take a step back on that. I've got opinions about it.
Yeah, I meant you,
it.
Plural you.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah,
all of us together for sure. One of the things that I've learned in the time that we've been doing it is that I can't be right all of the time. And I do need to step back and let other people make decisions. And it seems to go against my natural inclinations, but it's a necessity if you want to keep working with people.
Yeah, that's a really good point. But it goes back to that thing of actually it's a privilege. It's more work, but it's also a privilege to be working with people who aren't afraid to have different opinions and who do share their expertise. It goes back to being a very small company made up of people who've gotten together for a shared passion, I think.
Yeah. And you learn after a while that you're not right all of the time, and that the other person is a very integral part of what you do, that we're a collective, we're not individuals.
Yeah, this is related. So when I said, what I was already thinking, I was saying, so that's the design, which is interesting, especially in that sense of the progression. But also in terms of the group of people that you are, you're a microcosm of New Zealand, of another small group of people who are cartoonists in New Zealand, a sort of a...
Well, we're kind of a...
You don't like microcosm.
Well, given that we're all kind of straight, white, middle-class guys, that's a little bit not quite the case. It's, but comics in general are a weird microcosm of society. There's all the tensions and the battles that take place in greater society. And there's also weird things tied up with it, like economics. I learned about why you shouldn't invest in worthless stock bonds from working in a comic shop and seeing people invest, he says with air quotes, in comics that they thought would be valuable later on, which was not the case, and people losing money because of that. It, It's a weird thing to equate comics with the stock market, but it holds up for me.
Yeah, you're very right to call me out on microcosm. I didn't mean in the sense of being a representative cross-section. What I meant was just as you work closely together and weigh both the practical and the intellectual or creative, let's say not intellectual, the practical and the creative, so does everyone who works, who is a comics creator in New Zealand.
Yeah. I mean, yes, they do. We're working on a slightly larger scale in terms of the fact that we have bigger budgets and we've got more established networks and things. But yeah, some of the things that you learn as a comics creator go into running a company, running a publishing company.
So you've been talking about comics. I remember a conversation I had with you once about comics, and you said it's a sort of an outsider, a pursuit for outsiders. Do you remember that? Am I quoting you correctly?
Yeah. I think it is. I think it, a better way of putting it in on reflection is that it's a... I think it offers... Comics offer a unique platform for people with distinct visions to get them across.
Well, that's really well said. Well done.
They're relatively inexpensive to put together. They don't have people who are acting as gatekeepers, though some people might say that Earth's End's a gatekeeper. I don't agree with that, but we've got different decisions that we have to make as publishers. So somebody can sit down and they can produce a comic, and as long as they've got access to a photocopier, then they can share that vision.
Or online also.
Or online. Yeah. And comics online has changed the landscape of the comics world hugely. It's incalculable what a difference that's made to that world. It's opened it up to so many people in ways that I really struggle to understand. It's such a big change.
You've said also that comics creators tend to be people who work in a solitary manner. I actually thought a lot about that because I was thinking, well, all writers talk about that, how horrible it is to have to lock yourself in the room and get your word count done for the day. But I was thinking perhaps what it relates to, I am right, aren't I, that you had a tie there with solitary and comics.
Sure.
That possibly because when you're writing just text, you get descriptive. You have to describe and also punctuate with the dialogue. Whereas when you're doing a comics, the design is the description. So you actually really have to get to the essential. The text is much more essential. It's much more...
Well, text and image, it's like, that's a big topic in comics. But in terms of getting back to the individual creating in the room by themselves... Because comics, up until relatively recently, have been like a minority interest, it meant that people would produce these things and then the people that would actually share it with them were relatively small. But that's beginning to change, and to be honest, I have mixed feelings about that.
And about Earth's End contribution to that.
Yeah, and Earth's End's contribution to that, making it... more of a commercial as well as an artistic endeavor.
It's a fascinating topic, and I wish we could go on and talk about it more. So, Kelly, you're just going to have to come back.
I'd love to, Karen.
Oh, that would be wonderful. So, in the meantime, it's Rufus Marigold, and it's available in all good bookstores.
It is.
And from your website.
And from our website and comic shops as well.
Which is
www.earthsn.co.nz.
You heard it from Kelly Sheehan. Ka kite anō, everyone.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Kelly. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day.